Hello everyone and welcome to episode 3 of the Skype show. Today I'm joined by Michael Lamontagne and Marie Maximo. And tonight we're going to be talking about backing up Skype for Business. And Mike's going to take session 2. He's going to be talking about the path to Skype for Business client deployment. And Rui's going to be on in session 3 talking about Skype for Business edge security. As ever, session 4 will be questions and answers. You can use our Yammer group to ask questions or use the hashtag Skype for B show on Twitter to ask you questions during the broadcast or in session 4. So we look forward to presenting this content to you and hope you enjoy it. Session 1 is backing up Skype for Business. Before we back up Skype for Business, or we talk about backing up Skype for Business, we really need to look at what do we need to back up, when do we need to back up, and what do we use to back up. So when do we need to back up? That's usually going to be out of hours. Whether you need to have intermediate backups, full backups at weekend, the usual backup considerations, what tools you're going to use to back up, whether you need additional investments in backup technology or whether your existing investments can back up your application, and obviously the frequency as well. So planning your backup strategy, you sort of do it in reverse order. So to back up, you first need to plan your restore strategy. So with a good restore strategy, you get you'll back up your deployment properly and in line with your SLA, etc. So when you restore, or when you plan your restore strategy, you should be asking yourself some questions. What happens if my front end server fails? What happens if my mediation server fails? What happens if my load balancer fails, etc.? And then you plan to restore around that. So when you create your recovery scenarios, your backup plans and strategies automatically get designed for you. So if you've been working in backups with backup applications in the past, you'll have noticed there are a couple of acronyms of RPO and RTO, and the recovery point objective, which is RPO. And this basically means the amount of data loss the business can accept before it becomes impacting on either commercial or operational functions. So this usually means like the business can only accept 4 hours worth of data loss. Maybe it's 2 hours, maybe it's a day, maybe it's a week, but that will be set by the business, and you should be talking to the business and getting that RPO defined. The RTO, the recovery time objective, is the amount of time that it's going to take you to restore your RPO. So that's usually going to be the amount of time it's going to take you to rebuild VMs or your restores back. It's important to get the RPO and RTO set, written down and agreed upon with all your business stakeholders, so your COs and CXOs, and make sure that the business signs up to them. Once you have them set, you can start to build your recovery strategy and your backup strategy in much more detail. Different applications have different RPOs and RTOs. So if you're familiar with Skype for Business, then you'll realize that Skype actually depends on a lot of backend services, such as Active Directory, SQL, certificates, Exchange, via unified messaging, and meetings, etc., office web app servers. Also, it extends out into the network, so you're talking about reverse proxy servers and load balancers, etc. All of them have configurations on, and shared configurations as well. So these subsystems underneath obviously have their own RPO and RTO SLA against them. So Active Directory, as you can imagine, it's going to be quite an intense RPO, where you're going to say, well, actually, I can only afford half an hour, 15 minutes worth of data loss, or as opposed to perhaps a file server where you can accept a day or 2 days worth of data loss. And within each application, you might have a subset as well. So you might have a different SLA for object recovery, as opposed to schema recovery, as opposed to a complete domain restore. So each of those RTOs are going to be different. Not all RPOs are mitigated only by a backup. So in order, we don't want to wait for a failure of a system and then immediately restore from a backup. We want to be able to incorporate some kind of fault tolerance and resiliency within your network and within your deployment. So obviously with Active Directory, you've got multiple domain controllers that you can install that will replicate the AD between them. And also with, I think it was it 2008 R2 or higher, you could have object recovery through AD recycle bin. When we talk about SQL, we can say, right, well, we're going to use clustering, mirror, availability groups, and we've also got built-in resiliency recovery using the log file replay functionality. With file servers, we've got highly available file server available within Windows called DFS with DFSR, and also shadow copies as well, which you can enable to restore files at multiple times in the day. And within Skype for Business, obviously we have pooled roles and pooled servers. So by adding more of the same server into the same role, we can mitigate a failure by adding servers and reducing increasing the fault tolerance rather. High availability at all levels is obviously a key mitigation, and that's depending on designing a complete HA solution for all your subsystems. So Active Directory, multiple DCs, multiple DNS servers. You need to ensure that you eliminate all your single points of failure as well. So that's if you look through the OSI model from layer one, which is hardware, to layer seven, which is applications. So it extends from just Skype application into server OS, into server hardware. So multiple network cards, are you going to team them together? When you team them together, the network cards together, are you going to connect one network port to one physical switch and connect the other network port to a second physical switch? So you have high availability at the network layer as well. And then obviously you're going to need to have multiple exchange servers, and if you've got 2010 or 2013, that could be multiple mailbox servers with database availability groups, client access servers, UM servers, etc. The list goes on. So a lot of my customers will come to me and say, I want high availability for Skype for Business, and they just think it's three servers for the front end pool, and that's what they think they have. And it turns out, when I explain to them the in-depth detail that we need to go into to ensure HA throughout the deployment, they do raise some eyebrows, but it's an important consideration to have. Like, there's no point having a single file server with an enterprise edition pool, because if you lost your file server, you lose your confidence in data, address book, etc. It also helps to buy you time during a crisis. So if you did lose your front end server or an edge server, etc., you don't have to worry about having to restore straight away. You've got time in the bank, as it were, to bring that server back online. So what's your backup when you're backing up Skype for Business? And really speaking, the most important backups that you do are on your backend systems. So SQL that holds your CMS, your location database, the user data, etc. You need to ensure that server's backed up regularly. Exchange UM, obviously you need to ensure if you've got voicemail services, you need to back up the mail box so they'll be able to access historic voicemail. And also backup of the UM box, you will get the voicemail policies and the assignments backed up too. Active Directory is a given, file servers and your CA. Extending out from the Windows platform, obviously if you've got Enterprise Voice, you need to be doing regular backups of your session border controllers, your SBAs, contact centers, load balancers, reverse proxy servers, etc. Every part of the Skype for Business is a networking application, really, from the ground up, and it touches on a lot of applications and moving parts. When you back up, it's important to keep all your backups in sync. So when you're backing up Active Directory and Skype for Business and Exchange, you make sure that you have a backup at the same point in time, if possible, because you don't want to be restoring just a single application or a single workload, because that could lead to problems when you come to restore. So we'll come on to that a bit later, the problems that you can see if you just restore a CMS, for instance, and forget to back up your Active Directory, etc. And we could talk about, you know, if you back up Skype for Business but you don't back up Exchange Unified Messaging. So the backup technology for Skype for Business there isn't one, to be fair. Skype for Business doesn't support VSS backups. It doesn't support snapshots or host level backups. And if you have a look at the Microsoft recommended articles, they recommend script backups for Skype for Business. However, other subsystems, Active Directory, SQL, Exchange, supported backup tools for them, for those applications. So for SQL, you can use the built-in SQL backup routines and through maintenance plans and scheduled tasks, etc. And for Exchange, you could use a backup tool that will interrogate the mailbox database and truncate logs, etc. Try and avoid any backup strategy that will freeze the state of a machine, especially virtual machines. So when you're backing up a VM, a lot of people will use host-based backup. That generally pauses the virtual machine while it takes a brief snapshot, backs up the snapshot, and then releases the snapshot. Don't do that with Skype. It's just, you'll lead yourself into problems, especially in enterprise editions. You could have problems with your front-end pull, quorum through Windows Fabric, etc. Not to mention, if a user is having a conference, or participate in a conference or a voice call using mediation role, and you freeze that server, then they're going to have problems. So where's the data stored for Skype for Business? So the configuration is stored in Active Directory, it's stored in SQL databases. Backing up the Skype for Business core applications is less of a critical risk than the first imagine, because all the data is elsewhere. So all the main roles of Skype are basically service and transport roles. So they provide the access to the service, and they are responsible for transporting a user's communication from A to B, from user A to B, and what have you. All the information is stored elsewhere, stored on your back-end service. So they're more important than your Skype for Business service in the backup strategy. When you back up that important data that's built into the backend servers, you can perform that using built-in backup commands. So Microsoft provide you a handful of commands that will enable you to do a full restore in the event of a total loss scenario. And these don't have to be performed on each individual server. They can be performed on a management server. So many people have a dedicated management server away from the front end servers and what have you to do their management from and run their scripts, etc. So to back up the critical data, there are seven steps really to back up. So obviously the topology is the first major thing to back up, configuration item, sorry. And you can use that command export CS topology to export the most recent one. Then the CMS, we can do that through the export CS configuration commandlet, and that will export the data within the CMS database from the backend server to a zip file, and inside that zip file will be an XML document containing that data. And again, we can go through location databases, user data response groups, and when we get down to file share and archiving and monitoring, we can use native backup technologies for buffer both roles. When recovering your Skype for Business deployment, you need to make sure that you have a recovery point for all your subsystems. So restore your Active Directory first if you need to, restore your certificate authority if you've got a total loss scenario here, then so restore your SQL, file shares and data, and then restore Skype for Business on top. So it's quite a methodical approach and a logical approach to that too. What happens if you restore just parts of your scenario? So if you restored the CMS, for instance, and didn't have an up-to-date Active and your Active Directory changed, so perhaps you had a user who got married and changed their surname in Active Directory, changed their SIP address, but then you've restored a Skype for Business to an older version, then you could end up with having orphaned objects in the database, especially when it comes to response groups. So if that user is a member of a HUN group and the SIP address has changed between restore and now, then you're going to have to be going to the SQL database and make some deletions and some edits to bring that user back into the HUN group. As well, you know, if Active Directory is out of date, you could have a bunch of users who are disabled for Skype for Business and that were that were enabled before the restore. And you could also have different SIP addresses, DDIs, etc. The other important scenario to think about is reoccurring meetings. So if you restore to a point in time, then users may have to reschedule their future meetings. So not all recoveries are a total loss recovery. So you know, we've talked about briefly about total loss recoveries and total loss backups, etc. But 9 times out of 10, because of the resiliency within Skype for Business that you build in, there isn't a need for a total loss recovery. So we do there's more of a need for an item level recovery type thing. So perhaps you have a service desk who makes a change to a user, and that change breaks something with the user, but it's not immediately apparent, and you need to revert that change. So usually what happens in that scenario is that the technician will make that change, will inform the user. The user will say, yes, it seems to be working. The ticket will get closed. 3 days later, the user will phone up, say, I've got a problem with this. Another technician will look at this problem, and then we'll have to revert that change. So to try and make sure there's a balance within the team for experience that might not always be there. So to have some kind of backup or some type of protection against change or about change, you need to look at a bit more in depth of within Skype. So we can start by exporting policies, etc., to XML files, which basically act as the item level recovery. So in order to do that, I created a script a while ago, and there are other backup scripts out there. There's one very well-known one that I can't pronounce his name. I'm going to try, but I think he's called Lassie Vido. His backup script is a really good script for total loss recovery. And what I was looking for was a way to do an item level recovery. So say if I deleted a normalization rule, perhaps in PowerShell that I shouldn't have done, I want an easy way of recovering that without having to restore everything, because there could be other policies that have changed between the last backup and now that are actually working. So you can go and download my script using the link on the slide there, or it's on TechNet Gallery. It supports the latest Skype for Business CU, and it can be run on your management server. It doesn't have to be run on the front end server. Easy single item restore using one line of PowerShell. So it's literally two commands to restore. So here it backs up all the configure, as well as backing up your total loss backup. So it backs up topology, CMS, user data, etc., response groups. It will also look inside the database and extract the policies in individual XML files. And you can back up a complete deployment in under 5 minutes, depending on how big your deployment is. It'll do multiple pools, etc. So I'm going to make a quick demonstration. We'll base it on this scenario here, in that, like I explained, I need to make a change to a normalization rule. I've accidentally deleted the wrong one and I need to restore. And how would I do that using the backup script? Just bear with me for a couple of minutes while I switch my video feed, etc. So hopefully you can see my screen. And here I have my server up and running. So first of all, I want to perform a backup. And it's as easy as running the PowerShell command. So as you can see, we've backed up the entire configuration and it's stored in this file here. And it's just a quick backup. So under configuration, we have each individual normalization rule backed up to an individual XML file. So if I was to accidentally, on purpose, as it were, delete the wrong normalization rule, so now we have no normalization rules here. So we're in a situation where we've just lost our enterprise voice capability. And to try and save some time, I've got some restore scripts. So if I want to do an all files restore, I can look at that, extract the backup. So here, change the directory to the working directory to this backup and the right folder in the configuration, etc. And then we can walk through all the XML files within that normalization rules folder. And then all of a sudden we've got our normalization rules back in one go. We can also do single item recovery, and that would be basically choosing the exact XML file that you want to restore. And as you can see, we're using a native PowerShell command called import CLI XML to the path of the XML, and then we're passing that into the required command for Skype for Business, whether you're doing normalization rules, voice policies, etc. So the usefulness of this this scenario is that it provides your service desk with the ability to restore really quickly, just single items. Taking this backup further, what I plan to do is use the logic that I built into the HTML report that shows policies are assigned to users, etc., and use that and be able to restore user state as well. So at the moment, it backs up policies and configuration, and we can restore those configurations and those policies, but at the moment we would still have to manually run the grant CS command to grant the required policies to the user if they had changed. Hopefully in the next few months I'll be able to build that functionality back into the backup. That will actually recreate that path map as well. That's it for backing up Skype for Business. Made a mistake on that slide, but next up is session 2, not 3, and that's the path to client Skype for Business deployment, and that will be presented by Michael. I'll just pass over to him now.
All right. Hello, Skype for Business community. I'm Michael Ameltang, and you may know me as Real Time UC on Twitter. And I'm here to speak about the path to Skype for Business client deployment. So thank you for tuning in. The reason for this session is I'm finding organizations are struggling with client deployment or completely neglecting the client rollout conversation until after a UC project. So my goal is over the next 20 minutes to cover as much as possible to start the conversation. Now, if I say Skype at all in this presentation, I'm only talking about Skype for Business and not Skype Consumer. So how bad could it get when client deployment isn't managed? This screenshot was taken from a recent health check where I used Pat Richards' Get CS Connection script, which lists 1,800 active users using almost 60 client builds. Imagine the support nightmare trying to isolate or resolve any client-related tickets. The scary thing is, this isn't even as close to the worst I've seen. Think about this slide as I go forward through this presentation. So what are the options when it comes to the Skype for Business or the Windows Skype for Business client? With both Skype for Business 2016 and Link 2013, there are two editions available, basic or full. The full client can be found as a standalone or part of the Office 365 Pro Plus or Office Professional Plus. The basic client is a free standalone install, which does have some reduced functionality. The Link 2013 clients last year received a branding update that allowed for the ability to toggle to the Skype for Business client experience. Since 2013, the Link client has become part of the Office stack, so there are some Office requirements when looking to use the Skype for Business client experience. Please note that the Link 2010 client is leaving mainstream support this April. For the most part, the basic client has the same core functionality as the full client, but becomes quite limited when used with enterprise voice. Some of the advanced voice features like response groups, call forwarding, delegates, call park are not available. Also, the basic client is not licensed to be used with VDI. Good news, in October 2014, the basic client got recording and gallery view. I have found that the current published client matrix is a bit dated and still mentions the basic client doesn't have recording and can't schedule a meeting using Outlook. Enable Skype UI is a feature to toggle that enables the Skype for Business 2015 client experience for the Link 2013 clients. This was added in April 2015. This branding update would default the Skype or Link user experience depending on the server backend. If running on Link Server 2010 with February 2015 CU or newer, or Link Server 2013 with December 2014 CU or newer, the default client experience will be Link mode. Whereas Skype for Business on-premises or online will default to Skype mode. The Link client experience is not an option when using the Skype for Business 2016 versions. Enable Skype UI can be controlled via CS client policies or the registry. No matter the mode, after the branding update is applied, users will have Skype sounds, rate my call, Skype consumer video interop, more emoticons, but still no sheep, and you'll see the Skype in the Outlook add-in and program name. A first run wizard will appear in Skype mode unless suppressed. Remote call control is not supported in Skype mode. Whereas call via work, file transfer preview, call monitor, and the meeting tab are not in Link mode. So what's the difference between the 2016 client and the 2015 client experience? The 2016 client does not support Link mode, and RCC has been completely removed. ICE version 6 has also been removed, so this can be an issue if you have Exchange 2007 Unified Messaging. The Link 2013 VDI plugin version 1 isn't supported with 2016. So you can see that the 2016 client seems to be a house cleaning version where Microsoft is letting go of some of the legacy pieces carried over from older clients, which makes this client much leaner, reducing the CPU and memory hit. This client also opens the door for some great features like peer-to-peer video-based screen sharing, in-call QoE reports, and co-authoring. Note that if looking at Office 2016, Outlook 2016 does not support connecting to Exchange 2007. I was working with a client where we were deploying or piloting Enterprise Voice. Of course, I went through all the functionality testing before handing it over to the pilot user group. Later, I was called back in to assist with a few support issues where some pilot users couldn't configure SimRing. After troubleshooting, I found that the users without issues were still using the Link 2010 client, and pilot users with problems were pushed to the Link 2013 client. But it was the basic client. So with all these clients, versions, and builds, how do you tell what is installed? For me, I'm a fan of looking at one place, and the best location is the uninstalled registry keys. Of course, depending on 64 or 32-bit, there might be two key locations. Here I've written out the format for the key names for a handful of the Microsoft UC clients. I've actually published a script that will take a list of computers and remotely scan these keys and report what's installed. Also, the script will try and enable the remote registry service if not already started. This is probably a good time to mention I've included resources and reference slides into my presentation, which should cover everything I'll be mentioning today. There's two Office deployment architectures, Click-to-Run and MSI. You must start to think of MSI as legacy technology, where you go to your volume licensing and download ISOs. After that, you run layered servicing, applying a patch after patch after patch. Click-to-Run is basically Office as a service and is a modified version of VAPP for the streaming installation and updating. You can actually start to use most of the application's core functionality after the installer is about a third complete. Click-to-Run is licensed from your Office 365 subscription and is checked against an individual user periodically over the internet. The biggest benefit with Click-to-Run is Microsoft was able to rethink their development cycle, and from feedback, can turn around new features in 6 to 8 months. Where you would hear that prior, some changes would take 4 to 10 years in the MSI world. Now keep in mind, both MSI and Click-to-Run support offline use, group policies, and the APIs and object models haven't changed. Both architectures can be installed on Windows 7 or newer. So what are the use cases to stick with MSI? Well, if a computer is completely cut off from the internet, or if deployed in an environment that doesn't require new features, like an emergency room or air traffic control. 2 weeks ago, there was a video broadcast on some of the new features coming to the 2016 Skype for Business Click-to-Run client, like offline messaging and joining a meeting without a mic or speakers. Now, it was also mentioned that at some point these features would show in the MSI version, just not for a while. Also, you'll notice the Skype meeting broadcast presenter controls are not found in the MSI client. We can already see the difference in feature sets between MSI and Click-to-Run, and it's only going to increase. Other than a few scenarios, everyone should be looking at how to get on the Click-to-Run bandwagon. You'll notice that the remaining slides are here to insist on that goal. So if anyone is unaware, the 2013 version of Office 365 will start to auto-upgrade to 2016 at the end of this month, unless blocked. Also, as of February, the default Office download version on Office 365 Portal is 2016. If sticking with the 2013 version of Office 365, you'll only have access to updates until February 2017. Each version has its own matching deployment tool, group policies, and registry settings locations. Also, the Office C2R client, which is used for scripting the update process, has been relocated. 2016 removed InfoPath and introduced the channel update model, where you can pick a track to control how often new features light up for your users. It is Microsoft's recommendation to only have one version of Office installed on a computer. There are, however, some supported scenarios, but use at your own risk and test. I've created a table on some of the results I've experienced with specific scenarios. Mixing 32 and 64-bit will fail. 2013 MSI and 2013 Click to Run will fail. 2013 MSI and 2016 MSI will prompt to upgrade or allow for coexistence. 2013 Click to Run and 2016 Click to Run will upgrade similar products to the newest version without prompting. And if different products like Visio and Office are installed, you'll see an installation error. Using 2013 MSI and 2016 Click to Run, or the other way around, 2013 Click to Run and 2016 MSI, the apps will be installed in coexistence, but the older version apps may prompt to repair on first launch after. And of course, 2016 MSI and 2016 Click to Run will fail. I've also included some 2010 scenarios, and for the most part, these will be successful, but mixing technologies may cause the repair prompts for the 2010 apps. With Office 365, Microsoft introduced subscription-based licensing, which might be the single hardest change for enterprises to handle with rolling out Click to Run. The idea of having a user go through the activation process gives the rollout and training teams nightmares. And on the flip side, licensed users can now install Office on 5 computers, 5 tablets, and 5 phones. Licensing is checked daily or at logon and must connect every 30 days. To aid organizations transitioning from KMS to subscription-based, I've published a bulk provisioning script for Office 365 licensing that will grab users based on ADOUs and license users for specific SKUs and services. User activation does have some issues around shared computers. So Microsoft added the ability for shared computer activation. SCA can be toggled on or off at any time. Each user is still checked if licensed, but SCA doesn't count against the 5-computer account. After a user is checked, a license token is only valid for a small time period and rechecked every few days, so reliable internet is required. Users and administrators can use the Office 365 portal to view activations and deactivate. What is missing is the ability to do this from PowerShell. Proxies and firewalls must be configured not to prevent activation and checks. I won't cover Mac and KMS licensing as this hasn't changed for MSI installations. For all the licensing methods, you still can use the OSPPVB script to check license status and deactivate. When it came to running Link in a virtual desktop infrastructure, Microsoft released the Link VDI plugin version 1. This was a fat client install totaling over 700 megabytes. It only worked on Windows devices and is currently in maintenance mode. Version 1 doesn't support Office 365 or Skype for Business Experience, or the 2016 client, or Gallery View, Recording, Phone Edition, and many more features. Citrix and Microsoft recently announced the next generation technology for VDI with Skype for Business, which was a joint collaboration last year and is supported from both vendors. The big change from version 1 to version 2 is that the user endpoint is no longer is using SIP signaling and authentication directly to the Link or Skype for Business server. Currently working with the Skype for Business 2015 experience, the 2016 client is planned for the future. This is also done by a much thinner install and a part of the Citrix RTME, which means that those with pure remote FX or VMware View deployments will be out of luck for the time being. We now have a much larger range of supported user devices, even devices running Mac or Linux. This new solution removes almost all of the limitations of version 1. In the 2016 version of Click to Run, Microsoft introduced the concept of update channels. Prior to February 2016, it was called branches. The three main channels are current, which brings new features to users monthly, and is the default channel for Office 365 Pro and Business. The deferred channel brings new features to users 3 times a year and is the default for Office 365 Pro Plus. We also have the first release for deferred, which allows early access to pilot deferred channel features 4 months in advance. So if you look at February deferred build, you will have the same feature set as first release last September. For those that are Office Insiders, there is also a first release for current channel. You can jump between channels at any time, but all products on a single system must use the same channel. So can't have Visio on current and Office using deferred on one computer. The underlying update technology has seen some improvements and is using binary delta compression and bits to reduce file size and network impact. This is probably the simplest slide in this presentation, but is one of the most important. If rolling out Click to Run to multiple users, you must understand the inner workings of Office Deployment Tool. The tool is basically a small exe with command line switches and an XML file. With ODT, you can download the binaries, install with specific options, or create an appv package. The XML file sets what products and languages to install or remove, also the update behavior and level of user interaction or logging. Keep in mind, you can't control which features are installed, like Office telemetry. In this sample configuration file on the slide, we'll use a specific 32-bit build of Office 365 Pro Plus in the current branch using the specified path for binaries. It will install English and Chinese language packs and exclude installing Access. Also, if detected, Office 365 Business will be removed. The first language pack listed in the XML will be used as the shell UI language. We're also controlling the update location and users will see the setup wizard. SCA licensing is disabled and any Office application preventing the install will be automatically closed. The remove option only works with same version of Click to Run and not MSI. The great news is there is an online XML generator, which is included in the resources slide. Here I have a handful of deployment tips from the field. First, for the best user experience with Office activation, is no indication that activation is occurring. This is done if you have single sign-on using ADFS and the UPNs are matching between AD and the cloud. If that is in place, all you need to do is use a GPO and enable auto-activate Office with federated credentials. With the configuration file, pay attention to typos and incomplete attributes. The setup is very unforgiving, and if there is a mistake, the setup will just end or display a generic error. I like to have a separate configuration file with minimal options when using the download switch. The one that pains me the most is the fact that you should stay away from deploying the full Skype for Business Click to Run client as a standalone product. Instead, if looking to deploy only Skype for Business, deploy Office Pro Plus, and use the exclude app element to remove all the other Office programs. The reason for this is depending on the build, you'll have three results. Skype for Business will either crash on launch, there is a registry key which will prevent the first run dialogues that gets around this issue, but you'll still have the next issue where the activation doesn't detect your product. And the last, with newer builds, it will just end up upgrading to full Office 365 with all programs enabled after activation, which defeats the whole point of a standalone product option. Here I outlined how you can use the deployment tool and System Center Configuration Manager to control rollout of and updating of Click to Run. But why do this when last week Microsoft published documentation on SCCM 1511 and its native support for Office 365? Some people might know that System Center vNext or 2016 is now just called SCCM, and these are builds, and the builds are year and month format. So 1511 is November 2015 build. Starting with this build, you can use Config Manager's software update management workflow with Office 365 client. Currently, only the first release for deferred is supported, with current channel at the end of this month and deferred planned in June. Using the configuration XML or group policies, you need to activate the Office Management COM object, which enables the ability for Office to take commands from Configuration Manager to download and install client updates. You'll also notice WSUS in the list and might be thinking, sweet. Yeah, no. When a new Office 365 update is released, the update details are published to Microsoft Update and appear in the WSUS catalog. But to be clear, WSUS does not contain a copy of the actual binaries. When Configuration Manager sees an update in the catalog, Configuration Manager will request and download the updates directly from Office 365's CDN to the site server and then send to all your distribution points in the network. I've listed a few handy resources to aid in your deployment, and of course, a shameless plug for Skype Validator. As we all know, if the backend isn't deployed correctly, your users will have a poor experience. And with the time slot I had for this session, I wanted to give those that want to dig deeper a list of where to dive in. The slide deck will be made available online, so enjoy. I hope this session helped shed some light on the path to client deployment, and I want to thank the Skype show for inviting me to speak. It's now my pleasure to introduce our next guest, Rui Maximo. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. That was a great presentation. Thanks, Mark. Very enlightening. It's great to see the community helping out and give out information so that we can all share and grow and learn. So that's great. I guess it's my turn now to talk about Skype for Business security. So if some of you may know, I've been working on security for quite a while, for the last at least 5 years. And I've been in the product group with Skype for Business since 2002, worked on all the different product versions except Skype for Business 2005. If you've seen the protocol poster, I was the original author of that, did the first three versions of it, and written five books on the different versions of Skype for Business. We actually got a new one that's coming out at the end of, or soon. I don't know exactly what the date is, but it'll be Skype for Business Unleashed with Alex Lewis, Pat Richards, and Phil Sharp. So today I was just going to cover a little bit about security and also my products, full disclosure. So if you're deploying Skype for Business and you're exposing it to the internet, you'll know that you're going to be publishing Skype for Business or Link Server. And if I slip, I'll probably say Link Server. But you know that you'll be exposing it Link Server through your reverse proxy so that it can have access through port 443 on HTTPS. But if you're also exposing it through your Edge server, then you'll also likely expose your Edge server through port 443 for remote access, as well as port 5061 for MTLS connections, which would be Federation traffic with other organizations, or even Skype for Business Online, Office 365. Now, not a lot of customers will be deploying XMPP, so they probably won't have port 5269 open. And I certainly wouldn't recommend that because the traffic is unencrypted, so everything is going through the clear. So this slide here is just to kind of illustrate the different components that you'd be deploying in your DMZ, the ports that you need to open, and then the certificates that you would need. So hopefully this would be a handy little visual for you. So let's talk about security and the different threats. So can't really talk about security without understanding what threats are possible. And certainly, you know, a lot of us would have heard about telephony fraud and dial-up frauds on all those types of issues. And a lot of them will be handled by your SBC. But what a lot of customers don't know is that there's also attacks that are possible through your Edge server and your reverse proxy. So I'm going to cover some of those. Now, this is not meant to be a comprehensive list, but just to help illustrate some of the possible issues that that customers can be susceptible to. So the first one here is one that's fairly well known. It's denial of service attacks on user accounts. Now, what a lot of people don't necessarily know is that the moment you expose Skype for Business or Link Server through your Edge server and your reverse proxy, it's not just your Link accounts that would be exposed to denial of service attacks, but any user account, that any Active Directory user account that is susceptible to account lockouts. If you have an Active Directory policy, and if you don't, then of course, you know, they would be susceptible to brute force attacks. which is a big problem, because once somebody steals your password, well, you don't know because you still own it, and you think that you're still safe. And so that's security by lack of understanding or knowledge, which is even more dangerous than knowing that you actually have been robbed or been attacked. Another type of attack could be a denial of service attacks on meeting URLs. So a lot of us, if we have regular meetings, we'll have a scheduled meeting with a specific ID. And so once the hacker knows about that ID, they can just keep hitting it and at least at the very minimum, use up a lot of resources on your Skype for Business servers. And that could be a problem there, because it's using up resources, it's preventing your users from being able to connect to their own meetings. There'd be quality of service issues. So of course, there's some customers that will say, well, I'm going to be smarter about it, and I'm going to make my meeting IDs rotate, which is a smart thing to do, and they should do that. And so now that meeting ID is going to rotate, and it's never going to be the same. Now, that's not a foolproof solution, unfortunately, because hackers can still go and do a brute force attack on those meeting IDs and just rotate and just try everything, you know, all of the different permutations until they can hit one that works. And so that's still a nuisance at the very least. Cross-site scripting attack is another issue, not well advertised. That was initially discovered by Whitehorse Security, which is a consulting organization that does security. And they discovered this back 3-4 years ago. Luckily, I had already found out about it made a fix for it, made a way to block for those types of attacks in one of my products. Now, just to keep in mind, this is not an issue with Link Server or Skype for Business server itself. It's just a way that a user could potentially insert some bad payload in the URL. And cause clients, users to, when joining a meeting, to get owned. And so that's a problem. And I actually have a link here for some more details about that type of attack. Another type of issue is IP network mapping. So when you're setting up a meeting with an external party and you're internal, whether you audio, video, application sharing, there's going to be a list of candidates that's going to be exchanged through your StunTurn or ICE protocol. That's a negotiation to establish the media traffic. And so in that IP candidate list is going to be listed some internal IP addresses of your servers, of your clients. And so there are customers out there that don't want that type of information to get divulged outside of their corporate network, because hackers can use that information to do to map your network. And any information that hackers can get a hold of is something that they can leverage to their benefit and to your detriment as an organization. Mobile device protection. Now, it's great that we can all, you know, pick our mobile device, whether it's iOS, Windows Phone, or Android, download the Link client or Skype for Business client, mobile client, put our credentials and sign in. Boom, we've got access. It's great. Wonderful to have that type of flexibility and capability. But the problem is that you kind of have a proliferation of all these devices out there, because now I pick my iPad and I pick my kid's phone, and I'm just logging on to all these devices. And so corporations or organizations are like, we want to be able to control the number of proliferation of these devices that have access, that have sign-in access to our Skype for Business environment. And so they need a way to be able to control which mobile devices can access their corporate environment. And so that is something that more and more customers I see are looking for and trying to find a way to prevent and control which devices can connect to their environment. Another one is federation. So if customers have federation set up, whether it's with Office 365, which a lot of customers are starting to do more and more, but also with other organizations, whether it's Microsoft or a partner, it doesn't really matter. Well, federation, the beauty about federation is now you can communicate with other users in that organization and vice versa. You can see each other's presence. You can start any communication, but it does cause a bit of a privacy issue. Some organizations don't want to have all of their users to be visible and have their presence published to their partners. And so they want to have some level of privacy to be able to distinguish who can talk to whom and what type of modalities they can use, and even if there are some communications that that should not be going across the federated link in case of data loss prevention. So that could be credit card information, anything that could go through the IAM channel. So those are some of the concerns that are there. And so, of course, I have some solutions that help address a lot of these concerns. And that's what I've been focusing on for the last 5 years. It's always been my background. I graduated in college with a master's in mathematics, focused on cryptography, cracking RSA codes, and joined Microsoft doing security in the Windows group, as well as in the Windows Phone group. And then, of course, I never really left security. And so when I joined the Link group in 2003, I kind of did a bunch of different things in the product group, but then I came back to my roots. And so I have three different solutions called Active Edge Protection. And that's, you know, against denial of service attacks. Then we have also the mobile edge control that would prevent, that would help control which devices are authorized to connect to your environment. And then the Federation Ethical Wall, which would address the data loss protection issues, as well as presence privacy, if you will. And these are the different types of products that that help provide that level of solution across all these. Now, the nice thing about my solutions is that they build on top of each other. So once you've made an investment in one of the areas, say, for example, an organization decides to license the Active Edge Protection, adding on Mobile Edge Control or Federation Ethical Wall is just an incremental cost, not only just in terms of cost, but also investment in their infrastructure. Let's just go really quickly in terms of what that really means. So in terms of the Active Edge Protection, there's three components that I have. One is the security edge filter that's installed on the edge server itself. So there's no additional hardware that's required there. It basically filters through all the SIP traffic and then sees what the authentications are. The other piece is that, as I mentioned, when you expose Link or Skype for Business to the internet, you're exposing it to the edge server as well as to your reverse proxy here. And so I have also another component called a security web filter. And we now support F5 as the reverse proxy. And that's the intent. A lot of customers already have made an investment on their reverse proxy. They don't want to throw that away and have to purchase a specific reverse proxy just to provide this level of protection for Skype for Business. So we try to build something around what the customer has already invested in. And then the third component is the Security Filter Manager. That's our centralized database and management interface. And so the lockout count information and the number of times that a user has attempted to log on is centralized so that regardless of whether the hacker is coming in through the SIP traffic or through the web traffic, the same number of counts is logged and controlled. And so that's the value that that we provide in a nutshell. The other one is going to be the mobile edge control. And so here we have a solution that works with your MDM solution as well. So we have a mobile app that the user would have to download in order to do the registration. You do a one-time registration. And what happens is that the administrator would send an email, well, it gets automated, to send an email with a registration code. It goes through the registration process. And here you'll notice that the components that are used is going to be the security web filter and again, the security filter manager. The new components in order to provide this mobile edge control are the security device authorization filter and the mobile app that we have. And then finally, the Federation Ethical Wall solution. So again, here we have the security filter manager that we leverage again. We also have the Federation filter that is installed on the edge server. And then if you want to be able to set Federation rules based off of 80 groups, then you can leverage the security sync filter that provides the capability to set policy or federation policies based off of your 80 groups. And so all of these components build on top of each other. Of course, I'm happy to provide more information if you would like to reach out at me. And then here, I got to put in the plug, Skype for Business Unleashed. I've been working with on it with Alex Lewis, Pat Richard, Phil Sharp, of course myself. And we're almost we're in the final throes of finishing it up, and we'll be hopefully published pretty soon on Amazon. So with that, thank you for your time, and turn it back to Mark.
Thank you, Rui. And thank you everyone for joining. As always, the next session will be around for about 10 minutes or so to answer your questions. And just bear with me 1 second, seem to have lost the deck. Okay. So again, if you want to use our Yammer group to post your questions there, or you want to hit out on Twitter to Rui or Michael or myself and use the hashtag SkypeForBShow, and we'll answer your questions in the next 5 or 10 minutes. Our next show is going to be hosted on the 4th of April, so in a couple of weeks, because this show is a bit late. And our special guest is going to be Thomas Poet, and he's going to be talking about geographically dispersed edge servers. And we also have Mr. No More Phones himself, Mr. Jamie Stark, coming on, who's going to talk to us about Enterprise Connect and other new features coming out in Skype for Business. So join us for that on the 4th of April. And thank you very much.